Space Cowboy Books presents Simultaneous Times, a science and speculative fiction podcast. Short stories to stir the imagination by contemporary authors.
Fire in the Sky by Christopher Rocchio, with music by Red Blue Black Silver. Read by Jean-Paul Garnier and Zara Kand. The light of the burning village caught against the bottom of the clouds, turning the night a furious red. Iana ran hard as she could, dragging her little brother behind her. Twice Van's short legs had failed him, and he'd fallen. But he'd offered no complaint and scrambled back to his feet, eyes wide and bright in the light of a blazing grocery.
"Where are we going?"
he asked, gasping for air.
"Mother said we should go to the chantry. It's the other way."
Iana glanced back up the hill, over the clay-tiled rooftops and square towers of the village, to where the Terran chantry stood, with its green copper dome looming above all. She couldn't tell Van that Mother was dead, and that everyone who'd gone up to the chantry would be dead soon, too. Couldn't tell the poor boy that monsters had come to Cordalos, that demons had fallen from the sky. Van was not yet 8 years standard, less than half her age. She had to look out for him now. There was no one else left. Somewhere in the night, a woman screamed, and Iana's fingers tightened on her brother's hand. The river. They had to get to the river. If they could make it to the woods down past the old mill, they might have a chance. There was a place where the river ran down into a hollow beside a big oak tree in the forest's heart. A secret place. Mito always said it was the oldest tree on the planet. Always told Iana that same story when she slipped away to meet him there by night. They would be safe there in the forest. She was sure. If they could make it. Another peal of thunder shook the world, and looking up, Iana saw a lance of red flame crash down like one of the fireworks they set off at summer fair, trailing a column of smoke as if the clouds themselves were coming down in war. White lights flared where the tower's engines burned, slowing its descent enough so that its landing legs only buckled and did not break when it hit the ground.
"What are they?"
Van asked, stupidly.
"Is it extras?"
Iana only shook her head. Papa used to frighten her with stories of the extra Solarians, when she'd been just a girl. Tales of the machine men who dwelt between the stars and kidnapped misbehaving children. But those had just been stories. There were no machine men. Iana knew that much. Everybody knew that much. Mother Earth and the God Emperor had crushed the machines so very long ago. This was something else. She hushed Van instead.
"We're almost to the mill now. It's not far."
"But I'm tired."
Iana hissed, but checked herself. Van needed her, even if he didn't know it.
"I know! It's not far."
Away in the distance, Iana heard another scream, saw Van's face go white as new milk in the firelight.
"Come on!"
Again they ran, ignoring the shouts of a man darting past in the other direction, ordering them to the chantry. Iana just shook her head, heart pounding. Was that a body in the door of that house? She turned her head to see. Across the street, the Imperial Caravansary was burning. A wall of light and heat. Van gasped, and Iana felt the heat buffing her, even at 20 paces. She made to hurry past, but something in the doorway gave her pause, black against the orange glow. A figure, man-shaped, but more than man-high. It had to stoop to clear the low door of the Imperial building. The creature looked to Iana like some child crude sketch of a man. Its limbs were too long, its torso too short, its face featureless save for the huge, black eyes and the lipless gash of mouth. Jerkily, it turned those horrid eyes on her and Van, mouth splitting in a feral expression that bared a snarl of black and glassy fangs. Iana stood there for a moment, transfixed. Armored in all black, it was, in a suit that made her think of bones. Clinging hoses swung from its collar, connected to a heavy pack on its back. Teeth still bared, it threw back its horned head, white hair streaming in the heat of the flames. The sound it made, high and wailing and sharp as knives, froze every drop of blood in Yana's veins and turned her flesh to marble. Not so Van. The boy tore free of her slack-fingered grasp and bolted. Before Iana could snatch him, he was gone, sprinting up the street as quickly as his legs would carry him, a pale shape flickering in the firelight, a little flame himself.
Van!
Iana chased after him, fleeing the horned monster. The Zielsen. Iana had heard stories of the aliens, too. The Xenobites without mercy. It was the Zielsen Papa had gone away to fight, enlisting in the Emperor's own legions like so many of the men in the village. The sailors who came to Kordalos from the sea beyond the skies said they ate people, that they fell upon worlds and rounded men up like sheep and carried them off. Papa always said they were worse than the extras, that the extras were still men underneath. The Zielsen were all monster.
Van, slow down!
Iana shouted after her brother, clutching her bag at her side to stop it slapping her legs.
Wait for me!
But the boy did not wait. Iana could see the mill ahead with its sail tower rising high against the orange night and the ordered tree line beyond. At her left, the river ran fat and slow and dark, strangely peaceful measured against the horrible cries and inhuman laughter from the village at her back.
Yuka!
Came a rough, guttural cry.
Yukato Yukazi!
Iana risked a glance back, saw the monster loping after her, firelight shining off its polished white horns. Despite its stature and long legs, the thing moved slowly, hampered, perhaps, by the pack that hunched its narrow shoulders. Seeing her looking back, the Zielsen bellowed again.
Yukato Yukazi!
With one hand, the creature reached down and drew a wicked sword from a scabbard at its belt. The blade shone star-bright in the firelight, white as the monster's pale face.
Yuka!
Two more of the Xenobites emerged from between the buildings, carrying swords of their own, blades bent like broken fingers. Spotting Iana, the first turned and began to chase after her. Realizing she'd slowed, Iana turned and sprinted flat out.
Van!
Where had he gone? The old mill loomed ahead, and beyond it stretched perhaps half a mile of open fields where the drovers would graze their herds when they brought them into town for market. Van could not have crossed the field to the forest so quickly. Had he gone into the mill? Half-baked notions of drawing her pursuers off toward the woods formed in Iana's mind. She might not escape, might never reach the safety of the hollows by the falls, but the monsters might miss Van while they rounded up the village. Tears welled up in her eyes, and the clamor of alien feet on the road behind sounded to her like drumbeats. She was never going to see Mido again, or Papa when he came home, if he came home.
Stupid!
She hissed to herself and blinked away the tears.
Stupid, stupid, stupid!
She should have run to the chantry and died with the rest of the villagers. At least she wouldn't die alone. She looked back. The foremost of her pursuers was gaining. Onward it came, moving faster than the others. Against her wishes, Iana screamed. An instant later, she collided with something solid and hard as stone. She struck the ground with a grunt, the wind knocked out of her. Spluttering, she tried to get her feet back under herself. What had she hit? There had been nothing, nothing between her and the mill a second before. Fingers tightened in her hair and pulled. Iana gasped, cried out in pain as her scalp tore and blood dripped down behind one ear.
Let me go!
She heard her own voice as though it came from some other person, as if what was happening were happening to someone else. A fourth Sielsen peered down at her, yanked her head back to bare her throat. The Xenobite studied her with black eyes big as her fist, its slit nostrils flaring.
Let me go!
She heard herself say again, voice desperately small. Iana could sense no emotion in the thing. No malice, no hatred or rage. It was like something dead, though it moved and drew breath. The creature's jaws parted, teeth like shards of shattered glass, gums black and greenish, thick with slime. The stench of its breath was like a tannery, all acid and rot, and Iana choked as the odor filled her nose. It shouted something to the others, who drew up behind. The foursome made a cold and clicking sound like laughter that only grew stronger when Iana kicked the beast that held her. It shoved her to the ground, hissed words she could not understand. They were arguing, she guessed. Still in the dust, Iana found hands and knees, and scrabbling round saw the tree line. There was a gap between the Xenobites, just wide enough to make a break for it. It was that or die. Or worse, stay and find out what the beasts intended. Why had they not killed her yet? Memories of the stories Papa used to tell her came flooding back, stories intended to frighten her. The Sea Elson ate children, didn't just steal them away like the extras. Glass teeth snapping in her mind's eye, Iana hurled herself to her feet. She made it two full paces before taloned hands seized her and dragged her to the ground. The creature's armored bulk fell on top of her, and its foul breath felt hot on her neck. Iana screamed, flailed, tried to free herself, but it was no good. The Xenobite was too heavy. Its talons pierced her shoulders, pinned her to the earth. Iana turned her head in time to see the heel of one of the others fall like a felling axe. She did not feel the blow that wiped her unconscious. Someone was dragging her by her ankle. Her back felt raw and her head ached. Red pain lanced horribly behind her eyes, and when Iana opened them, she saw the orange firelight reflected on the low cloud and off the columns of smoke that rose like pillars to meet them. Only blearily did she remember the invaders and remember that Van was gone. Only slowly did she recall her mother was dead. She groaned and coughed, and with a start realized the thing that held her ankle was like nothing human. Hearing her, the Sielsen looked back and down and leered at Iana, transparent membranes flicking shut over its eyes. Looming ahead, one of the Xenobites' landing towers rose like a crooked finger, hellish red light streaming from the top of its open ramp.
Ayusha!
Said the creature, holding her to one of the others that stood near the base of that ramp. The guard tossed its horned head to indicate her captor should drag her inside and drummed a coiled silver whip on its belt. Turning back, her captor seized her by the arm and hauled Iana to her feet. It shoved her up the ramp, staying only one stride behind. Cowering, Iana shuffled on ahead, tears thick in her eyes. Van, at least, had escaped. That was something. But who would take care of him if both she and mother were gone? She tried not to think about her brother wandering lost in the woods, in the smoking village, seeing what was left of their ruined home. Would he find mother? What was left of mother? Torn and bloodied on the kitchen floor? Or had their house burned, too? As Iana reached the top of the ramp, she stumbled. The Sielsen behind her kicked out the back of her knee, and she hit the rough metal grating on the floor with a thud, felt her skin tear, and cried out. Huddled on the threshold, she heard a low snuffling, and looking up saw 50 faces staring wide-eyed at her. Human faces. Iana shivered, recognizing most of them. There was Ada, the miller's daughter, a little younger than she was, and Tula, who worked in the village pharmacy. Tula clutched her son close to her side. And there were others, and a few she did not know, but knew by sight. She recognized one of the Imperial couriers, a black-skinned woman from the big city downriver where the water met the sea, and a young, straw-haired boy who served on the Haywards with Mito. Luca? Lucas? With a sick, black feeling, Iana realized that almost all the prisoners were women and boys. Were the men all dead already? Clawed hands seized her once again, hauled Iana to her feet. She teetered there on the threshold a moment, swaying in the smoky breeze, and turned to look up at her captor. The Sielsen seized her by the throat, interpreting her glance, perhaps as defiance. Iana winced and put her hand on the Xenobite's iron fingers, tried desperately to prise herself free. But it was no good. The Xenobite was at least as strong as the strongest man Iana had ever known, perhaps stronger. She felt her feet leave the ground and kicked desperately. Her captor stared at her, face still void of all feeling, empty and implacable, her fate inevitable as the tide. A black tongue snaked out from between translucent teeth, and the Xenobite squeezed until Iana felt sure her neck must break. A blue light flashed, bright as suns against the darkness and silence. Iana hit the deck an instant later, legs buckling like wet sand. Her captor towered over her, swaying in the night air, headless. Iana screamed, and the women and the children in the hold of the tower ship behind all sucked in their breath. Another blue flash split the night like a wedge, and the creature guarding the base of the ramp exploded like a balloon filled with black paint. Shaking, Iana watched from the top of the ramp as a pale light descended from the night above, sinking like one of the little sparks that marked the passage of a weather satellite against the distant stars. But this was no satellite. As it drew nearer, Iana could see the torch beam tracking through the smoky air, questing like the blind face of a worm against all that flame-lit blackness. Two more of the Sielsen appeared from around the base of the ship, and another terrible flash lanced out and smote them before they could draw their whips coiled at their belts. The light drew nearer, and Iana understood. A man was falling through the air towards her, seeming almost to swim. So slow did he fall. Seeing him, Iana's heart rallied, and she stood and waved her arms, still gasping and spluttering for air. For the man wore the white ceramic plate and crimson tabard of the Emperor's legions. He floated to the ground, buoyed by some magic from the stars, and the blast of his lance was lightning sent to pass judgment on the monsters that had burned her home.
"We're here!"
Iana exclaimed, still waving her arms. She staggered down the ramp, breath coming in wheezing gasps. Her savior alighted gracefully, blue lights on his harness going dark. That questing beam of his swept the surrounding landscape, illuminating the scorched grass, the black shapes of trees backlit by the burning village beyond. In the distance, Iana could see other lights, blue and white, slow falling upon her village like a heavy rain. Like the first autumn snows that melted and were gone. Two more men in ivory and crimson landed not 10 paces from the first, their featureless visors scanning for danger. Finding none, the first man reached up and touched a point beneath his ear. His helmet opened, folded away like a paper sculpture, and bared his face.
You're all right, miss,
he said, raising a hand.
It's all right now.
Iana stumbled off the base of the ramp, nearly tripped over the broken body of the Xenobite who'd guarded the approach. She was crying freely then, and drew herself on the blue-eyed soldier. Evidently surprised, the man patted her on the back before moving to hold her at arm's length.
There are more,
Iana managed to say, pointing up the ramp. The man gestured to his compatriots, who hurried up the ramp.
It's all right,
he said again.
What's your name?
Iana.
Iana?
He looked around. More flashes of blue illuminated the buildings beyond where more of the soldiers were fighting. It was strangely quiet, Iana thought. War should be loud.
I'm Andros, Decurion of the 113th Centurion Legion. Are you hurt?
Iana touched her torn scalp, felt the blood crusted to her hair.
Yes, I think. Have you seen my brother? He ran towards the woods.
Your brother?
Andros looked at her, confusion twisting his shaved face.
No. We'll look for him. He'll be all right.
I need to find him,
Iana said, and started stumbling away. She could see the sail tower of the old mill about a mile off. She hoped Van had hidden inside. The Decurion, Andros, seized her by the waist.
Stay a moment,
he exclaimed, voice gone sharp. All soldier. A voice floated down the ramp from the black landing tower.
Found them, Andy. Bloody animals,
Andros growled.
Get them clear and plant your charges. Double quick.
Only then did he release Iana's wrist.
You're hurt, miss. We'll get you and the others clear. Medicals en route.
But my brother,
Iana said. For all she knew, Van was dead. She should have run faster. Shouldn't have froze up when the monster came walking out of the flames.
I have to find him. Sir, he's alone.
Andros bit his lip, gaze torn between Iana's face and the top of the ramp where the other soldiers were busy leading the battered and confused survivors of the attack to freedom. Iana sensed his hesitation, but feared this man would send her away to wait with the others until they bested the Sielsen and regained control of the village. Van might not have that long.
Please,
Iana said, not clawing at Andros, not going to her knees.
Please. My brother is out there somewhere. I lost him. We were running out of the village.
She'd let Van down, let Mother down. She should have kept a better eye on him, should have kept him close, shouldn't have frozen like a fool.
I have to find him. He's the only family I have.
She did sink to her knees then, sobbing silently. Andros put a hand on her shoulder and awkwardly hauled her back to her feet. Hissing, the soldier looked up to where his compatriot stood just inside the hatch of the landing tower. He seemed to chew something a moment. His tongue, his words. Presently he reached down to his belt and pressed something into Yana's chest.
Take it,
he said.
I have to get these people to safety.
He looked back up the ramp towards his compatriots.
We're not supposed to let folk wander off. But if you go now, I haven't seen you.
Iana grabbed the hard metal thing he pressed her. It was a gun, polished, black, and smooth. She had never seen a weapon quite like it before. It looked like a smaller cousin to the black lance that the Decurion held in his right hand. The weapon that spat blue lightning.
You have something to fight for, you fight for it.
He looked up into the night as if searching for something. Iana wondered what it was.
Go find your brother.
Iana held Andros' gaze a moment, still shaking. Van was still out there somewhere, in the mill perhaps, or gone on to the wood. The legions would secure the village, but her brother needed her. Iana sucked in her breath, nodded to the Decurion.
Thank you,
she said, and turning towards the night, she ran. Not from the monsters, but to her brother's side. Just the Facts, Ma'am, by Brent A. Harris, with music by Fog Machine, read by Jean-Paul Garnier and Zara Kand. This is the city. New Angels. Mars. I work here. I'm a robot. It was Friday, November 7th, 2114. The weather under the colony's climate dome was the same as every day, 2.2 degrees Celsius, with precise 4 p.m. showers. We were working the sun shift. My system administrator is an AI named Janice. My name's Stan. Most people in the colony are the law-abiding sort, but then there are the bad guys. Those who sow discord and dissent. That's when I go to work. I carry a badge. You say he fell? I asked the witness. We were standing on the Ceramisteel Street, outside the St. George penthouse apartments for the colony's premier residents, the ones who'd paid for the privilege of living in the same soft and cushy manner they had lived on Earth, 63 million kilometers removed. Judging by the smear on the street, the guy should have had a few more cushions.
That's not what I'm saying at all, officer.
The witness was a septuagenarian female who wore pearls and a pink summer dress. She was one of the second wave of arrivals to the colony, after the habitat was built. The rest of us arrived after. You could forgive her for not knowing how things worked around here now. Times had changed since she first stepped foot onto New Angels.
I'm telling you, he was pushed. I saw it.
New parameters uploaded,
Janice said to me over a secure comms channel. Thanks, I told her, using the same link. Janice always kept me plugged into the latest news. As the data files updated, I gained an understanding of today's case. With it, I gave the old woman another chance to straighten her story. Just the facts, ma'am. I'm sure that's not what happened.
I saw it from my apartment across the street.
She pointed to a smaller, less impressive tower close by, close enough to have seen and heard what transpired.
There was another man. The two of them shouted, which brought me to my opened window. I saw the one man push the other off the roof. I called the security and came down here to wait for one of their, robots. What do you call them?
Security Technologies Augmented Network. Stan, I informed her.
Yes, and you arrived.
She waved at the plethora of ambulances and other Stan units interviewing others. Though hope was beyond my programming, I hoped they were getting better stories than I was. Another alert from Janice, followed by her cool voice, brought my focus to an image she sent over.
The deceased's name is Joe Webb, aged 42 years, head of the Mars Liberation Movement.
Interesting. Webb was a dissenter. Perhaps the dissenter. He was running against the current governor. I had been told the polls were close, but I didn't trust the numbers. Clearly, they'd just taken a nosedive.
Isn't that Webb's apartment?
The woman asked.
What's going to happen now? Will they still have an election?
The body, or what was left of Webb, had been scooped up into a bag and removed. Doors slammed on the back of an unmarked van before it sped away. Janice sent over a new data file, formatting the first. As the files realigned, I instructed the witness. Business as usual, ma'am. You should check your news feed. I recognized her look as one of curiosity, an interesting human feature. as she fiddled with the on button embedded in her left temple. Most people, younger people, I corrected, left their assist devices on all day. Apparently, she didn't. No wonder she was so full of falsehoods. It took her a bit to access her assist, but when she did, she shook her head, as if dislodging her disbelief.
"Oh,"
she said.
"I had no idea."
"You see, ma'am, just the facts. As you can see, Webb just posted that he endorses the current administration and retracts his candidacy."
"I don't quite understand."
"He's not even dead. I shut down the file relating to the case. There's nothing to see here. Carry on about your day."
"Then what I saw?"
"Dissenters,"
Janice interrupted. She only talked to me, but the file sent over my link was the same one sent over the assist devices to every citizen of the colony. It showed an image of Webb clearly assaulting the other man. The result was the red smear on the street below. I told the lady. There was disagreement over Webb's endorsement, from within his own party. So you did see a scuffle, and a fall, but it wasn't what you thought it was.
"Yes, right. Of course."
She looked me over, eyes askance. "Is there anything else I can do for you?"
"There's a new show streaming on the Assist,"
Janice told me.
"From sifting through her social media use and her metadata, she'll find it interesting. A cooking competition, perfect for the holidays."
I passed the recommendation along. "You should be indoors anyway," I added. "It's almost that time."
"That sounds like a good idea. Thank you. What do I call you?"
"Stan is fine," I waved. I gave her the closest approximation to a smile as I could, the one the focus groups had approved. They found that by using it, I came off as more trustworthy.
"I'm sorry I got so confused, Stan."
"That's quite all right, ma'am. We just deal in the facts here." With that, the old woman ambled back inside to her living accommodations. Janice pinged me with the next case. A social media user needed correcting, possibly exile. It was just another day in New Angels. As I headed out, at precisely 4 p.m., it began to rain. In this episode of Simultaneous Times, you heard Fire in the Sky by Christopher Rocchio, with music by Red, Blue, Black, Silver, and Just the Facts, Ma'am by Brent A. Harris, with music by Fog Machine. Theme music by Dane Luscombe. Out now, Simultaneous Times, Volume 1, Paperback Science Fiction Anthology. Available at spacecowboybooks.com and lulu.com. Be sure to visit us at our store in Joshua Tree, California, or at spacecowboybooks.com. And connect with us on Instagram or Twitter. We'd love to know what you think of the program.